Universe. This is Matt Kramer, My partner, Jan Sircone, is off having adventures tonight. If you're listening in, Jan, hi. We're having fun. And ironically, if you heard that cough, about 4 or 5 hours ago, I started coughing. And my wife, Treya Palmer, who's been on the show before, naturopath, says I got a combination of a sushi fluke and some bacteria. So I'm going to allow our guest to do a fair amount of talking, but she has a lot of stories to share. And that's Penny Nichols. She'll be on in a few minutes. Let me do a couple of announcements. One, let me announce for Jan's behalf. Let me say, Jan is a voice bio-practitioner, and she's a singer. She works with sacred geometry and all forms of sort of out there kind of stuff. That we've got kind of a relationship where I guess I'm like the farmer looking at the, I don't know, the scientist or something like that. And, but we have fun together. Jan does voice bio, and voice bio uses the frequencies in your voice. You talk for a few minutes into a microphone, and she can read which tones are dominant and which tones are faint. And either way, it's a reflection of your physiological health. And if you play the appropriate tones a few minutes a day, you can do some rebalancing, and it's been, she can talk about all kinds of ways. It's been very helpful for people. And I've enjoyed her session. I came out feeling very relaxed. And then I do something called voice mapping, which is different. Voice mapping is about emotional healing, in which you take the recording that somebody makes when they're thinking about something specific. So if they're talking about a car accident or their mom or a divorce or something like that, there'll be a very specific voice map that comes up. And then those frequencies are played back to the person in a biofeedback process that helps unlock buried stress and traumatic memories and helps cut the connection to the ways that those old memories are impacting you, kind of a repetitive thinking kind of thing. To learn more about voice mapping, you can go to mattkramer.com. And if you're hearing the show, then you're looking at my name on the website, so you know how to spell mattkramer.com. And Jan's website is musicforjoyandhealing.com. And I just tried to go there, and it wouldn't come up, so maybe something going on with the internet ethos over in her part of the world. I do know that she has a couple things she wants you to know about. She's doing a workshop March 8th and 9th from 10 a.m. to 6 in Aptos, for those of you who live in California, it's up near Santa Cruz. It's called The Feminine Side of the Mysteries. It's a workshop with Randy Masters, and we'll be working on sacred geometry, experiential sound and activations, and something called the secret codes. So you have to ask Jan what that's about. And for reservations, Jan's number is 707-526-9852. Then on April 26th, she's inviting folks to join her on a trip to Egypt. Sound tour to Egypt with the Sound Masters, with Randy Masters and Paul Hubbert. Jan will be there toning with her gongs. They'll be at the Great Pyramid. There'll be a Nile cruise. You go to holographicsound.com and get more information there. Tell Paul that Jan referred you. I think it's there's some spaces left there, so you have time. And I'm going to move on to our guest, Penny Nichols. And I've known Penny, you've heard me say this a few times, I bring on folks I've known for years that I really like. And also because they've got a lot to offer. I probably met Penny in Los Angeles about 30 years ago. Really beautiful singer and writer and performer. And then we didn't see each other for probably 20 years, and then reconnected last year when Teresa Tadduri and I started doing Songs of Sonoma. And Penny was just here recently. If you go to pennynichols.com, PennyNichols.com, you can learn a little about Penny while we're talking. So, Penny, you ready to join the conversation?
Yes, Matt. Hi. It's
Hi
so
there.
Good to hear your voice and to be talking with you again and to hear about Jan and what she does. I'd love to. In fact, I am going to go to her website and read more about that.
Yeah, she does pretty amazing
things. Does there.
And I should let folks know that it's midnight in New York, and that's where Penny is at the moment. So thank you for staying up for the show tonight.
It's my pleasure.
And
actually, I've been up, staying up late every night for the last week, because last weekend was my songwriter's retreat for adult songwriters here in the Catskill Mountains called Winter Songs.
You do two of those a year?
Yes. Well, I do five retreats every year for songwriters, but this, we had Winter Songs West out in Cambria, California in January, and then in February we have Winter Songs East around Valentine's Day, President's Day weekend every year. And this year a lot of people had colds, but there were about 54 songwriters, and you know, this is an incredibly healing and empowering experience for people to write songs.
Yeah, let me say that as somebody who I've occasionally tried to write, I'm more of the talent coordinator side of the business, but when I've attended songwriting camps, the walls come down, the barriers and the filters, and people are just open, and they're sharing music. It's a great place to, even if you've never written a song before, it's a good chance you'll come out having written one. Do you want to say more about that?
Well, what I've noticed, this will be our 10th year of putting on Summer Songs is the name of our organization. It's a nonprofit organization. And this will be our 10th year of putting on our big week-long camp in August in the Catskills. And what I've noticed over the years is that when people come to camp, and these are all adults, I have to tell you, it's not really a camp for kids, they open up when they start singing, because you end up singing all week long, because you're either singing Beatles songs, or you're singing your own songs, or you're writing a song and singing it, or you're singing somebody else's song, and people singing opens people up and allows them access to their own feelings in a way that normally I think we, you know, if you're just used to just normal conversation, there's a lot of emotion that doesn't get conveyed sometimes. And then when you start singing a lot, all of a sudden you have access to a whole world of feeling in yourself that you're not normally in touch with, and so people get very emotional at camp. When we had our camp in Cambria, in fact, there was a gentleman there whose brother had died during the Vietnam War, and I sang a song that I wrote for my brother who died during the Vietnam War. I'll Never Be That Old Again. You know that record,
yeah.
Right? And he came up to me in tears afterward and told me all about his brother. And those are the kinds of things that, for some reason, songs and the singing of songs brings out this just kind of a deeper level of connection and ability to connect with our own memories and our own past and things that have happened to us.
You've had well-known performers there over the years.
At camp?
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, we try to pick teachers and performers who are well-known in the singer-songwriter world as great teachers. So our first teachers were Bob Franke and Steve Gillette. And out here on the West Coast, Kenny Edwards and Wendy Waldman and Mary McCaslin have all been involved with Summer Songs West and Winter Songs West, as well as Severn Brown, Jackson Brown's brother, who is also a great songwriter in his own right. And our dear pal, Teresa Taduri, came and taught this last Winter Songs for the first time, and she did a great job.
I bet she blew people away.
Oh, yeah, she did. She totally blew people away. And we had another wonderful new teacher, Harold Payne.
Oh, yeah.
Who came and is just an incredible singer. He really got everybody up out of their seats. And
the only reason I haven't had Harold on this show yet is he works every Wednesday night.
Well, eventually it's going to work out. But
yeah.
And he is just one wonderful guy, that's for sure. And Cozy Sheridan is another great mm-hmm. teacher who comes and joins us. Anyway, all of these people are great songwriters and singers in their own right. Most of them are nationally touring musicians.
Yeah, some folks may not know that Kenny Edwards worked with Linda Ronstadt for years and did a lot of her arranging. Wendy's had hit songs, I know, with the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band and a lot of other songs you've heard, you know, as the writer, and hope to get her one of these days.
I don't think that would be very difficult.
She's in this new trio with Cindy Bullens and Deborah Holland.
Yeah. And the name of the trio escapes me at the moment, but...
Oh, it starts with an R.
Yeah, but the only place I've seen them playing so far has been at the conferences. But I'm sure they're going to be doing house concerts. We'll have to look up the name of their group. In any case, just to get back to the subject of singing and songwriting and healing.
The refugees.
The refugees, right, that's it. Great, good job.
And a lot of people don't remember, but I talked to, I mean, Cindy Bullens was a pretty major rock and roll star in the 80s.
Uh-huh.
But, so I mentioned her name and people go, yeah, there's kind of remember that. But she's a real sweetheart.
Yeah. Carolyn Aiken is another teacher who's taught with us at camp, and we've just been very fortunate to have a lot of great songwriters and singers and teachers, and then actually the people who come to the camps become very good songwriters and singers over the years, watching them grow and mature as songwriters is thrilling.
Do you have any particular stories?
One of my favorites has to do with a guy out here on the East Coast who is a therapist who started coming to camp in 2001. And when he first came, his performance when he would get up to sing would be to cry and hold on to a big teddy bear. And then he would kind of go into a screaming, crying thing.
A rebirthing or something?
Yeah, kind of like a rebirthing. And nowadays he is singing whole songs with a beginning, middle, and an end, and filled with stories that he wants to tell about his experiences, and he tells them through songwriting, and he's communicating his ideas very well. And in fact, he and I co-wrote a song that's on my 8 Voyages of Nep CD that's coming out in April, and I recorded it. And it's called Calvin, and it's about right whales who migrate along the Atlantic seaboard and are getting close to being extinct. And it came out of a newspaper article we read about one right whale who they've been monitoring for years, and how she keeps coming back from the cold Newfoundland waters with new babies every year, and how she's keeping the species alive.
Uh-huh.
And it's a great song about triumphing over adversity.
Now, you sent us a CD, which is a preview of that album.
Yeah, and that was Four Seasons Road, the first song that you played at the beginning of the show. Four Seasons Road is a song. I have to just preface this by saying that for my whole life, ever since I was about 15 years old, songwriting has been my way of interpreting and understanding what happens to me in life. It's my way of symbolically experiencing my own life. And it gives me a way of looking at what I'm going through that's very healing for me. And I don't think I could have described it to you that way when I was 15.
I was going to say.
Yeah, but now I look back and I see, yes, this is what songwriting does for me. And it always has, and I just couldn't articulate it or see it clearly.
Well, speaking of being 15,
that's what it was.
Speaking of being 15, you've had a fascinating career. And can you do an encapsulation of your journey?
Well, my mother was a singer in a big band, and so I always sang as a child and took lessons and started singing professionally when I was about 15. And I grew up in Orange County with a number of other singer-songwriters, and we had a club called the Folk Swingers Club that met at the Paradox. And some of the other songwriters and singers were Jackson Browne and the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. All the guys in the band were from Orange County, and Jennifer Warnes,
mm-hmm.
and Jack Temption, another famous songwriter.
Jack wrote Peaceful Easy Feeling and Already
yeah.
Gone.
And also Tim Buckley.
Uh-huh.
And anyway, we all grew up together and started out at this club called The Paradox. And I used to open the show for a lot of people there. And then we all moved up to Hollywood about the same time. I started opening the show for people at the Troubadour in the mid-60s and doing the Hoots there and working at the Ashgrove. And then I went up to San Francisco in 66. I went to Vietnam first in August of 66.
How old were you then?
I was 18.
And why did you go to Vietnam?
My friend Kathy Smith from Orange County, who was part of our group,
I remember
at the Paradox,
yeah.
She and I were a duo called the Greasy Mountain Butterballs. And we got that name from John McEwen and his brother, who I had been in a band with them called the Greasy Mountain Butterballs.
Before the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band.
And then Jackson left the Dirt Band. John took his place, and his brother Bill started managing the Dirt Band. And I asked John and Bill if I could use the name Greasy Mountain Butterballs for my duo with Kathy, and they said yes. And so Kathy and I were touring around Orange County singing as a duo in the Greasy Mountain Butterballs when this woman came up to us and asked us if we wanted to go to Vietnam and sing for the troops. Well, we were both fancied ourselves as being in the anti-war movement.
Mm-hmm.
So our plan was we were going to go to Vietnam and sing protest songs. And that when the soldiers heard the protest songs, they would, of course, put down their weapons and come back home. That was our plan. So, anyway, to make a long story short, we got over there, and the people who sent us over there turned out to be a front for a prostitution and smuggling ring.
Good gravy.
And they took our tickets away from us, and it took us 3 weeks to figure out what was going on and bribe the right people and get our tickets back and come home again. But after that, I went to live in San Francisco and became part of the hippie movement in North Beach, and sang at the Avalon and the Fillmore and the Matrix and the FW Coup, which was a little club in the old Spaghetti Factory in North Beach, opened the show for a lot of people there, including Big Brother and the Holding Company, which was Janis Joplin's band, and Steve Miller Band, and the Jefferson Airplane, and the you can see some old, you know those posters that they had for the Fillmore
and the
Avalon?
Posters, yeah.
Yeah, you can find my name on those posters. Let me just put it that way.
That was about 67?
Yeah, 67, and then went to New York and made a record for Buddha Records with Artie Rip.
Artie Rip.
Yeah, called Penny's Arcade, which sold over 50,000 copies. And then I went to in 68 I went to and toured Europe with Buddha Records and went to London and stayed with Alex Martis and Jenny Boyd in their house in London and recorded at Apple Records.
That's when
with
you met
George Harrison.
Harrison.
Huh?
That's when you met George Harrison.
Yeah, and Patty, because I was a friend of Jenny Boyd's in San Francisco. That's how I got involved with them.
I don't know the connection between Jenny Boyd.
Jenny is Patty's younger sister.
Okay. That was...
And Patty has written a very interesting autobiography that just came out about those years.
Okay.
And anyway, so when I came back... In 68, and I came back and went to Mexico for a few weeks. And when I came back from that, I found out, because I had come back from Vietnam and told my brother Greg, who was 14 months older than me, and he was a Green Beret,
mm-hmm.
and I came back from Vietnam and said, under no circumstances are you to go to Vietnam. Don't you dare go. And this is why, because we were made aware of all of the corruption and the greed and the graft that were going on there, both in the military and in the government, the Vietnamese government. And it just was, there's no reason why we should have been in Vietnam in the first place. And I didn't want my brother to go over there and get killed, you know.
And you were able to convince him?
Well, I think I was able to convince him, and he went AWOL rather than go in 69. In 68 he went AWOL. Unfortunately, he got sick anyway. And he was living underground, avoiding the military, and he contracted leukemia, and he passed away in 1970.
Do you think that was related to his experience?
There's really
in Vietnam?
No way of knowing. I don't know. I don't know. But he was considered a veteran, and... He and I were very, very close. We were like twins. And I went into a very deep depression and dropped out of the music business and went to live in Ocean Park, just south of Santa Monica.
Uh-huh.
And basically was in a very serious depression for until 74, 75, and I was writing songs, but I wasn't doing much else. I was afraid to leave the house where I was living. I was kind of reliving my brother's death over and over again, and I was afraid of death and afraid of open spaces, and had a lot of trouble with getting on with my life. So finally, and I was married to, you know who Harry Shearer is?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was married to Harry Shearer. And
he was in a credibility gap back then.
Yeah, we were doing the credibility gap, and he had a great show on radio in those early years called Destination Music.
Is that KRLA?
Yeah. Well, no, it was on KPPC.
Okay.
In Pasadena. And
I used to hear him on KRLA with the Credibility Gap.
Right, right. That was even before the KPPC.
Yeah.
They moved to KPPC, the whole Credibility Gap. And
I remember he played a character called Sam Andreas out in the Mojave Desert,
yeah,
selling future beachfront property in the Mojave Desert.
Right, right.
Yeah. And now he's kind of a major character actor.
Yeah, the Gap once did a great, really funny bit on their show called Lake Van Nuys, which was supposed to be, you know, after the big one
hits,
then Van Nuys is a lake. And anyway, it was very funny. But in any case, I was having a lot of trouble, and eventually Harry and I split up, and I went into therapy and spent about 7 years in psychoanalysis, and that was when I began to really figure things out and start to get some help for my depression. And that really worked. And in combination with that, I started writing songs again. And it was through meditation and therapy and songwriting that I came out of my depression. And then I went to back to school at Antioch and got a double degree in music and psychology.
And psychology.
Yeah, and then I got accepted into Harvard in their graduate school of education and got a master's degree and a doctorate in music education, specifically in the field of the psychology of music and how people remember what they hear musically. And that's what I was doing during the 80s. I was studying Buddhism, starting to write songs again, and putting my life back together, and working on my dissertation.
You know, I read an article yesterday. I think it was a Finnish study that was looking at victims of stroke and three groups. One group listened to music, one group listened to spoken word, and one group didn't listen to anything. And in terms of, I guess, sustainability and healing, the group that listened to music had something like 3 or 4 times the success rate of spoken word.
Oh, yeah. I believe that. That makes sense. You know, I've been meditating now since 1977, and I think that one can begin to see the value of visualization, and the value of being able to use your mind to create visualization. You know, because in order to use your mind to create visualization, you first have to be able to let go of discursive thought to a certain extent, you know, to build an image in your mind and hold on to it.
Well, you're creating an alternative perspective from the one you've been sort of dwelling
in.
Right,
right. And meditation has been tremendously beneficial to me in being able to do that, and it was also a wonderful replacement for me from marijuana, which I had been smoking marijuana in the 60s and early 70s and writing songs, and I found that I could not sustain that. But that was not a good place to be.
Well, the mythology,
as a songwriter.
But the mythology was that the psychedelic or the marijuana would actually enhance your songwriting.
It does for a while. The problem is that you cannot, it's not something that you can sustain forever, you know, for your whole life. Because there are other side effects that weren't so good. But the meditation, I found that with meditation I could get the same focus that I was having with marijuana in terms of songwriting without the bad side effects.
With better results.
With better results. And so I think actually when I started really seriously being able to write again, because when I stopped smoking marijuana, I couldn't write for about 5 years.
But when you stopped, there was a 5-year gap?
Yeah. And
you had to heal from that.
I think so. But then in 1985 is when I started writing again. My first song I wrote was called On the Hudson, and it was about the Hudson River. And because I was living by this time at a Buddhist monastery in Woodstock, New York,
mm-hmm.
and commuting from Woodstock over to Cambridge to go to school. And I'd cross the Hudson River every time
Pete Seeger went,
so I wrote a song about the river.
Yeah, Pete Seeger's done a lot to try
yeah.
to save the Hudson.
Yeah, and I sang it for Pete and the Clearwater, Sloop Clearwater people at a benefit one time. But that was the beginning of kind of rebuilding my songwriting health and singing health. And I've been doing that ever since, and through a lot of other things that have gone on. Then I had a whole series of... I got remarried to a wonderful man, my husband, Mark. And we tried to have some children, but that I ended up having 5 miscarriages. And so there was a lot of grief and healing to be worked on with that in the 80s and early 90s. And so I started finding that I could channel some of that grieving into songwriting. And so anyway, to make a long story short, that's how the song Four Seasons Road was born.
The opening song.
Yeah, the opening song was after moving to New York. I had a chance to really kind of step back from my life for a minute and look at the whole landscape of my life and begin to have some insight into what was going on with me through that song and get a sense of where I could, how I could begin to transform my experience into a healing experience through the songwriting. So that was one of the first songs that helped me do that.
Now, we haven't heard any music for half an hour. You have a song.
Do you want to hear another song?
Yeah. You've got a song queued up called Grist for the Mill.
Yeah, this is another one. This is the song that I wrote after all the miscarriages.
Uh-huh.
And this one really, really helped me deal with my grief over that.
Okay, so get Seth to roll CD. We'll listen to Grist from the Mill by Penny Nichols.
What are the signs?
Well, I've always loved your music, Penny. It's a real delight to be able to hear this.
Yeah, and these, you know, this song, Grist for the Mill, these are songs that wouldn't have fit on, you know, the last record I made, the I'll Never Be That Old Again record, which was more of a retrospective of all the different kinds of music I've been doing throughout my career. But these songs are very specifically related to healing and grieving, because that's, you know, very important to me now. Grist for the Mill, the point in the song when I'm talking about the water, the tears flow into the river, the river turns the wheel of the mill and grinds the grain of grief into loaves, into bread that the birds eat. It's because there's nourishment in tears. There's nourishment in acknowledging one's grief.
Especially
and grieving fully.
When you allow yourself to grieve.
Yeah.
Because many people don't.
Yes. And so that's the point I was trying to make in the song. And I felt like I really got to it when I said, and helps my heart to heal. You know, so bring it in, bring it in. It's all grist for the mill. And in any case, just to move on from that, all these songs are all in this new project called The Eight Voyages of Neb.
What is Neb?
N-E-P, like pen, like penny backwards.
Okay.
It's my name backwards. And the what prompted this whole project was that in 2005 I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And so in the process of dealing with having breast cancer, you know, how is a regular person, just an ordinary woman, supposed to deal with such a terrifying prospect as breast cancer? And my way of dealing with it was to do with breast cancer what I do with everything in my life, which is turn it into a creative process.
Did you start with the
symbolic journey?
Did you start with the classic steps like denial, anger?
You know, I was so terrified when I first found out that I had breast cancer. I wouldn't have called it denial. I felt like I was looking right into the face of what I thought death was.
Mm-hmm.
And because my brother had died of leukemia all those years earlier in 1970, and I watched him go through all of that with the treatments and everything, I just assumed that breast cancer was a death warrant for me. And so my initial shock and terror was based on these old memories of my brother dying of leukemia. And I had to look instead at, from the perspective of meditation and visualization and actually doing my practice as a Buddhist, I had to sit down and really look at what is death. And I realized that I have absolutely, literally, no idea
mm-hmm.
what death is. I have no idea.
Although you've been around it.
And no one else does either. What happens beyond death is a mystery. It is a profound mystery. And what I realized is that I can make this experience, as long as I'm alive, I can make this experience anything. I can make it a terrifying journey, or I can make it a liberating, healing, beautiful experience. And so breast cancer survivors have these choices to make along their journey. How am I going to experience this? And So for me, I had 8 chemo treatments that summer, and so I wrote 8 essays.
In one summer?
Yeah, in the summer of 2005, as every 2 weeks.
Okay.
During that time, I wrote 8 essays about my treatments and sent them out on the internet to my support group, and each essay was called a wave. So it was the first wave, the second wave, the third wave, the fourth wave. And I decided that rather than it being a journey that I was on, that it was actually my very brave alter ego, Nep, was actually the one who had the courage to go through this. And I was just along with her for the ride, you know? And so that I could be afraid, you know? But I wasn't alone. I had my alter ego, Nep, to help me through, along with all of my, you know, the love, incredible love and support of all of my friends and family. And so I started writing songs about healing based on having transformed my own experience of my breast cancer into an experience of empowerment and healing through my writing and through the meditation. And I am, in fact, completely well today. So, you know, that doesn't mean that I may never have breast cancer again. I may not, but I'm not going to say I'm never going to have breast cancer again because I don't know.
Sure,
you know?
Nobody knows.
But I don't know if I'm going to be hit by a car tomorrow when I go out either, you know. So it's in the same ballpark with that, you know, rather than it being right, you know, on my front door every second. So I continued to write, and I wrote a number of other songs. I know we're running out of time, so but they're all on this new record. I wrote a beautiful song for my mother. I'd never been able to write for her, and finally was able to write a song called Grapefruit for her.
How was your mother supportive around your music career?
No. She, even though she had been a singer in a big band when she was younger, she taught me how to sing, but then she was afraid I'd never make it in the music business, so she wouldn't let me take any music lessons.
Really?
Yeah, I had to take secretarial classes instead.
Well, what about when you were touring Europe?
Well, by then, you know, she didn't have much influence over me by then.
But was she acknowledging at all that you actually did?
Not really. My mom, bless her heart, she did the best she could, but she wasn't able to play the role of being a mom very well. But she was the kind of mom who would say, come over, I'm having a big party and I want you to sing for all my friends. And then you'd go over to the party, and while you were singing, she would go around the room and try to distract people and have them pay attention to her instead.
This is the kind of thing that when I'm doing voice mapping, it comes up for people, that kind of stuff that sticks with them, the sabotage.
Yeah, yeah. There was it was a lot of that kind of behavior, but I know that she really loved me as well as she could. She just wasn't very well versed in how to do that. But you know, that goes into her background and, you know, what a sad story she had. But in any case, I'm very happy with where I'm going with this healing music, and
it's also very healing for people to come to hear you.
Yes, yes, and it's healing both for the listener and for the singer.
Right.
So when I sing these songs now, I feel the healing actually happening to me as I sing them. And so it's like vitamins, you know. The more you do it, the better you feel. And that's the way it is. I wrote a song, I guess it's now about 9 months ago, called The Healing Light of Love, which is the last song. It's going to be the last song on this new record.
I'll start that in a couple minutes.
Yeah, and I was literally taking a walk near my house, and I'm walking down the road at a certain pace. This is a great way to start a song, by the way. Walking along, and then you just start, the song just kind of came through me. I just started singing it, the chorus of it. I am becoming stronger, because I was feeling stronger, you know. Mm-hmm. I was getting over the neuropathy in my feet and the feeling of the arthritis from the treatments and the medicine, and the radiation had finished, and I feel myself getting stronger every day. You know, it's been almost 3 years now, I think, since my diagnosis.
You did that songwriting workshop when you were here about a month ago, and that exercise of walking around the block as you're thinking about your song, that was a really great little suggestion there.
Yeah, well, you know, we write songs. Songs come in our bodies. You know, our bodies are the vehicle for songs, and so when you're actually moving and doing something with your body, you're creating the right conditions for songs to manifest.
When are you going to be in Northern California again?
Well, as it turns out, Summer Songs West is going to be in August this year,
okay.
August 17th through the 22nd. And it'll be in Cambria, California. And if people are interested in songwriting, you can read about it at the website summersongs.com.
Summersongs.com.
Yeah, and that's when I'll be back out to California. We'll be in August.
Well, we hope to have you up here again.
Well, I would love to come back up there. I would like to actually spend some time and learn more about voice mapping.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, that's a date. So it's getting towards the end of the hour. We want to hear The Clear Light of Healing.
The Healing Light of Love.
The Healing Light of Love. There we go. So, Seth, are you there? If you are, roll CD. Thank you all for listening in tonight. We'll be back next week, Wednesday at 9 p.m. California time. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you all soon.
In every life, some darkness falls.